All right. Thank you, Andre. It's really nice to be back. This is actually my second MT Marathon in Prague. Both Andre and I were here a long time ago when we were both a lot younger looking. Let's start with a history of MT. And so one of the things, so I'm going to give sort of a broad overview of what's going on in machine translation and touch on some of the high points that the other lectures are going to fill details in the course of this week. Some things are going to be maybe a little hard to follow for people who haven't seen all of this at the beginning, but since I know everybody has very different backgrounds here, I wanted to try and have a little something for everything. So one thing, machine translation really goes back to the earliest days of computer science. In fact, you might even argue that it was the first real application that people were excited about after the end of the Second World War, when people started thinking, what can we really use computers for? So we can take credit for sort of starting the computer revolution, I'd like to say. So the 1950s were an era of optimism of MT, and this is something that that we should do well to remember, I think. In the 1950s, people thought, you know what, MT is basically a solved problem. They had a few sort of toy sentences. They're a little equivalent of the, you know, maybe the Moses system from those days that could translate Russian and English. And they were like, you know what, this is going to be taken care of in a few years. Well, after 10 years, when this still hadn't happened, this really, really nasty report came out arguing that machine translation wasn't just solved, it was an inherently insoluble problem. This is called the ALPAC report, and it basically killed MT for, you know, 25 years, at least in a sort of serious academic setting. But fortunately, you know, we just kind of went underground and continued doing some interesting stuff, continuing to develop the sort of formal foundations that that we use today. And importantly, during this interim era, people started playing with statistical models for not for translation, but for speech recognition. And they were doing this. This was a private company, IBM, that was doing this. And this really worked. And then the guys who were who developed the speech recognition system at some point were bored of speech, and they said, we need something a little bit more fun. And obviously, machine translation is the most fun problem to think about. So the head of their group was on vacation for a couple of months. They prototyped a machine translation system, that became known as was published eventually as the Brown et al. 1993 paper, Statistical Machine Translation. That really sort of reinvigorated interest in machine translation. And in the 1990s, we saw people really seize on to this idea. And we had, I think, an important event was 1999. We had an open source re-implementation of those models that had been proposed about 10 years before at IBM. And since then, you know, it's been really something that's, I think, captured the imagination of a lot of people. And we've also started to see that this has turned into a truly commercial viable thing. So Google Translate launched in 2005, 2006. Just a few years ago, SDL, which is a real language services provider, they acquired LanguageWeaver, which was a statistical machine translation startup, you know, really sort of cementing the fact that people who do language for a business sort of said, look, we need to think about machine translation. And then now here, we are here in Prague for the 2013 MT Marathon as part of this long and illustrious history. So as I, you know, sort of go on and move further away from doing useful work, I think history is kind of interesting to think about. But that's really going to be all for that. But one thing I want to make is that the way we view translation today, the statistical approach, is something that goes way, way, way back to the earliest years. So during the Second World War, the Allied codebreakers were very successful at cracking the German Enigma code and solving cryptography problems in general. And of course, you know, this for those of you who haven't seen this, you certainly will now, probably as long as you stay in the field. But the idea is, rather than to think about machine translation as an AI problem or as a language understanding problem, it's to think of it as a cryptography problem. And so this really, you know, what we're doing today, I think, is a direct descendant of this idea. And so I'm going to show a model now that plays a fundamental role in machine translation, called the noisy channel model, that is an instantiation of this idea that when we want to translate from Russian into English, we say a Russian article has really been written in English, but it's been coded in some strange symbols. And the idea is basically, I know something about English, I know something about the code, and now I'm going to proceed to decode. So how does this work? Well, this goes back to this guy called Claude Shannon in his mathematical theory of communication that was finally revealed to the world in unclassified form in 1948. And he posits that all communication, not just translation, but anything, happens like this. You start with a message you want to transmit. You encode this in some way. You have a distribution over the messages that you want to, that you're going to be sending. So this is important. This is what are the kinds of things I'm talking about? If you know you're the New York Times, you're talking about news. If you're, if you're a warfighter, you're going to say, you know, updates about what's going on in the field. Then you're going to have this noisy channel. And what this is going to do is it's going to be a statistical corruption of this input. So, you know, if you're thinking about an encoded message as a series of zeros and ones, you could be flipping zeros and ones with some probability. We're going to be thinking about changing words from our underlying English message or Czech message into our underlying English message into something like Czech that we can't read. And then we're going to get a receive transmission that is all we get to observe. And our challenge is going to be to build a decoder that's going to reason about what we've seen, this receive transmission, and go back to figure out what was underlying at the beginning of this. So to use this theory, we need two quantities. We need a probability of the source and a probability of how the a model of how the channel behaves. So for each source, we want a statistical characterization of how it gets garbled in transmission. So I'll show you how this maps onto translation in a second, but it's really useful. You can use this to show to reason about a whole bunch of other really cool problems. So how does this work? So in general, we've got these two variables. We've got our observed X, and we want to get this received message. We're going to do this as follows. We're going to say, I'm observing some X, and I want to find the Y underlying this that maximizes this posterior probability. So what's the probability of Y given X? And the thing that I'll notice is, even though I've assumed that I've got this underlying source model and then this channel model, those are two different probabilities. P of X given Y and P of Y given X aren't the same. So we can turn to our very serious friend from the 18th century, the Reverend Bayes, and use his theorem, which follows very straightforwardly from the definition of conditional probability. It's not really a profound insight these days. Just flip this around. And we'll notice that the denominator here doesn't depend on Y. So to reason about this, we just have to say, we want to find the message that maximizes the probability of the prior probability of that message according to our source model, and then the corruption of that message, the probability of the corruption of that message into what it is we observed, X. So if we think about how we might want to translate from Czech, it's going to look something like this. We're going to assume that all of our messages underlying this were in Czech, which we're going to indicate with a variable f, because, you know, it's Czech. And we're going to search over the English strings, to find the best one that maximizes this this expression here. And so when we have these two quantities, we can refer to them as the translation model. So that's the P of E given F, and a language model, which is the P of E. And this decomposition of the problem is of really fundamental importance. And let's look at that a little bit more in more depth. So this division of labor tells us that we need two things. One, a translation model that tells us how to go from English back into the source language. So it's kind of a backwards model. And this is going to be there to ensure that the translations that we've got are adequate, that they preserve meaning. And this is sort of the focus of a lot of research in MT. Most of us work on this. And these models, we estimate them, you know, we use these empirical procedures to learn models. And these are learned from parallel sentences or parallel documents, source target translations. So we want to go out and look in the world and see how people have translated things in the past to learn how it is that English tends to get garbled into Czech, is the idea here, and characterize that statistically from those examples. Now, the language model has a different job. It just tells you what the probability of the output sentence is. So we want probability distributions over English sentences, and if we're translating into English. And this can be learned. The nice thing about this is you can learn this from any examples in English. It doesn't just have to be parallel corpora. You just need to have a really good understanding of how English works if you want to translate into English. And this is going to roughly make sure that you're behaving like you're producing sentences that behave like they should in the target language. And so, you know, one thing you might say is if we go back to this this picture and say, well, look, we learned how to characterize this channel probability, which is the probability of F given E, and then we're searching over a conditional probability E given F. Well, why not just use whatever we did to model the channel probability to build our translation model? And that's a good argument. And, you know, in fact, some people have argued that maybe we should just model this thing directly. In fact, maybe kind of that's what we're doing these days. But the intuition behind this division of labor is really, really important. There's nothing necessary that says you have to use Bayes' rule, but there's an intuition for why we might. And the first point is you get much better use of data when you do this. So we have parallel data, and it should say we also have lots of monolingual data. Typo on my slide. So the idea is we want to be able to use as much as we've got. So we don't want to have to neglect the fact that, you know, there are billions of words of English freely available on Wikipedia when, you know, we've only got 25,000 sentence pairs of Swahili English when we want to learn to translate from Swahili to English. We want to be able to use both to the extent that's possible. The second point is somewhat related, which is we can use weaker translation models. So our channel model doesn't have to be quite as good if it can kind of outsource some of the responsibilities for modeling that marginal distribution over outputs to a separate model. And another way to think about this is, We have two sets of models. We have a model of sentences by themselves, and we have a model of sentences given sentences in other languages. In both cases, we're constructing distributions over sentences. And obviously, the one that has to condition on extra information, that's a harder task. And so, in general, these are going to be weaker, less well-estimated models. And so we want to be able to sort of give ourselves the ability to, you know, not have to solve every single problem in the translation modeling. and because it's a harder problem. And then finally, I'd say, you know, language models are, of course, now used. This noisy channel decomposition has been applied to a lot of problems. And so there are guys down in statistics or over in electrical engineering or wherever who tell us how to make better language models. We also sometimes tell them how to build better language models. But if any of us make improvements, we all benefit. And so there's a kind of practical benefit to dividing up the labor in this way. Okay, so the big question is MT is how do we design language and translation models? And in general, this is a hard problem because we want the model to be both correct and we want it to be tractable. We want to be able to actually do stuff with it. And then finally, also, we want to be able to learn the parameters. So, you know, you can say, yeah, there's this logical form underlying every sentence, but, you know, it's hard to find instances of logical forms out on the internet unless you put them there yourself. So to get an intuition for how we build these things, let's consider language models. So this just says, you know, what's the probability of a sentence? We're going to think about this in terms of probabilistic models now. Now this is hard because there are an infinite number of grammatical sentences in any language. There are, of course, way more ungrammatical sentences. And you might think, you know, this is the era of big data, but infinity is way, 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 way bigger than big data, even than big data. It's amazing. For machine translation, in general, we use a very naive model. We don't try and say, well, you know, linguists know a lot about how language works. We instead say we're going to use a simpler model and we're going to rely on the fact that we do have a lot of data to estimate its parameters. So this naive parameterization is going to, you know, collapse. It's not going to know very much about things. So related word forms like walk, walked, walking, all of that, those aren't going to be captured at all by the model. It's going to, the difference between walk and demonstration is going to be completely missed. And that obviously seems simple, you know, seems naive. But the only thing where we do really sort of recover from this is we're going to use really clever estimation of parameters. And you're going to learn about this later this week. Okay, so why does the language model work, you know, really matter in translation? This is a very funny book that I recommend. It's Jonathan Safran Foer, Everything is Illuminated. It's narrated by a Ukrainian, this guy is supposed to be a Ukrainian translator, who basically learned to speak English from a bilingual dictionary. And so he has a really good translation model, but he has never been exposed to English, so his language model is off. And so you get these great lines like, my name is Alex Perchoff, but all of my many friends dubbed me Alex because that is a more flaccid to utter version of my legal name. Mother dubs me, Alexei stopped spleening me because I am always spleening her. If you want to know why I'm always spleening her, it is because I am always elsewhere with friends and disseminating so much currency and performing so many things that can spleen a mother. And so, you know, for those of you with a sophisticated English language model, you'll realize that, you know, you can imagine what he means there, but it's not typical, and that's why it's funny. So if you want funny output, you know, don't work on language modeling. Okay, so how might we model do language models? So our naive model is going to look something like this. We're going to say that sentences are nothing more than sequences of symbols. And we'll talk about various things that those symbols might be this week. So if we let sigma denote the set of symbols that we're going to be concatenating to form these sequences, then we're going to consider, we want to define distributions over all possible elements of the set sigma star. So that's just the Kleene star. It means 0 to infinite number of repetitions of symbols of sigma. And we want to define probability distributions over this. Now, this is obviously a really big space. We can't just say, well, you know, this sentence has probability, you know, something, and this sentence has something else. We have to use finite means. It needs to be a computable function, this probability mass function we want to build. So The way we in general are going to be building probability models is doing three things. We're going to make some independence assumptions, and we're going to rely on the fact that the probability of two things, X and Y, happening is just the product of the probability of those two things, if and only if those two things are statistically independent. And if those two things are actually independent. And so what we're going to do is we can say, you know what, I know that the verb depends on the subject in sentences, but I don't want to model that. So we're going to assume that that is true. And that's going to let us define models that maybe don't quite correspond to reality, but might have fewer parameters, because in general, you need, as you model more and more variables jointly, you need an exponential number of parameters. And then finally, we're going to estimate parameters from a sample of data. And so for language models, we might do something like this. We might say that we're going to start and we're going to generate a word, and then we're going to, conditioned on the word we just generated, generate some other word, you know, according to some probability. Then we might say, instead of remembering what happened two words ago, we're just going to say, in my model, I'm going to assume that that is independent of, that the probability of the next word is independent of what came before, if I know the previous word, in this case, want. So we can build sentences like, I want a flight to Prague, and then we'll have to also say, well, do we keep going? No, now we're going to have a probability of saying stop, that the sentence is over. And so each of these little events is going to have a probability associated with it, and this will be a way we can define probability distributions. Okay, so this seems reasonable for English. We have a nice language. If I say in English, I have a bad headache, we could imagine I have a bad, you know, toothache, and there are a lot of shared properties of those two sentences, and in the model we just described, there are going to be a lot of shared parameters. That seems intuitively correct. Now, if we were speaking Chukchi, which is a Siberian language, it would look like this, which doesn't even have any words. People just always have headaches. No, this is supposed to be a really long word. It's a single word. Yeah, what's that? Oh, and no, I know it doesn't. It's not showing up. Oh, there it goes. Okay, this is why you shouldn't copy your slides to a different machine right before the talk. Okay, so here we've got this long word, temmeyum levelos. Something. That long word means I have a headache. And obviously, if you are just modeling words, complete, full-formed words, one at a time, you're going to have to know a lot of words in this language for which there probably is not a lot of data. And that's because these languages have these rich morphological processes that generate words. And so we might make different sets of independence assumptions, like a word generates, you generate the stem, and then conditionally independent of what came before, or maybe conditionally independent of the stem you just generated, you generate its morphology. And so we're going to be talking about factored translation models and factored language models this week, which are going to be one possible solution for modeling things like this. Okay, so let's go and here at the end of the talk to actually talking about translation models. We're going to use the same bag of tricks, namely we're going to make some naive assumptions about what's going on in the world of translation so as to model the translation process. And here, instead of just modeling, as we said, a particular sentence independent of context, what we want to do is model a translation of a sentence given the source. And we have the same challenges we had in language modeling, you know, infinite-sized things. We want to be able to learn the parameters of these models from data. So I'll first quickly say some things about how we might, what kinds of assumptions we might want to make and use that to motivate a sort of general way of thinking about translation. So let's say we've got a sentence here, in der Innenstadt explodierte eine Autobombe, sorry. That's actually a joke from the beginning of a movie. Let's say we wanted to translate this. So We're gonna make some independence assumptions. So what are those assumptions gonna be? Well, we want to maybe first permute the words from the source sentence into a target language order. So this means, a car bomb exploded downtown. But in German, the way this is said, it says, in the downtown exploded a car bomb. So the sentence order is a little different. So we want to model this permutation process. So we might break the sentence up into these pieces. You know, here, this prepositional phrase, the subject and the verb. And then we might just, independent of their content, we might just say, we're going to create an output structure that looks like this. And no, we're not saying anything about what the contents are here. We're not saying these are prepositional phrases, these are modifiers, these are subjects. We're just saying, you know, here's a way to move these things around. Then we're going to pick translations for individual words and phrases. And, you know, we can model that maybe by looking at the source context. We can do, you know, or we can just make, you know, we can basically pick up a die and say, I've got a list of translations for explodierte, and I'm going to pick one randomly by throwing a die. We can use more complicated models. We'll learn about those this week. And then we're going to fill in translations, though, of each of these little blocks independently of each other and get a sentence, maybe a car bomb exploded downtown. So this model is pretty close to the state-of-the-art statistical model that's used today, but it's got some serious challenges, which makes it an interesting one. So despite its naiveness, I should say. So searching all permutations of anything is an NP-hard problem. And so, you know, we're basically solving a traveling salesman problem every single time we translate. Now, it fortunately turns out that we can know a priori that some orders are not going to be as likely as others, and we, you know, can get around that problem. And that's before, that's just to deal with the way we reorder things. After we've reordered things, we still have to worry about the massive numbers of different translation alternatives that might be out there. You can get an idea of this if you go to any bilingual dictionary. You'll see, you know, for a word like, you know, explodiert, you're going to probably see, you know, in a really big translation dictionary, you know, lots and lots of options. If you try and learn these things from data and see the actual richness with which people translate, you realize that that's, you know, a very, very small portion of what actually happens in the real world. So we have to solve both of these really, really hard problems. So that being said, this is a popular model. It's called string-to-string translation. It works probably still to this day best it is the best model we have, for especially for closely or typologically similar languages. So it's approximately what Google Translate and Bing Translator use. But you know, we know it's got limitations. The independence assumptions are wrong, and we're missing out on all the stuff we know about language. But the reason that it's been so successful is that models can be learned directly from parallel data without too much difficulty. And so that's really been why this is so successful, I think. Okay, what is parallel data? So parallel data exists out in the world. It is example translations. And I just wanted to put this in here now to realize that really why we are here is that people realize there is a lot of this stuff out there in the world that was created for no other reason or other than people do translation. This is something people do, and we can exploit this. The fact that there's all this data, the fact that the United Nations publishes in its 5 or 6 official languages doesn't have to do with my desire to have lots of parallel data to train my translation models. It's because they need to publish in these important languages because they have people they're communicating with who speak different languages. So there's a lot of stuff out there that you can use to learn to translate. And of course, you know, a famous example of learning to translate was the Rosetta Stone, which taught us how to read Egyptian hieroglyphics because we knew how to read this language here at the bottom, ancient Greek. Okay, so that's just an aside there with parallel data. I assume all of you are familiar with that. So, okay, what else might we have done here? We made some independence assumptions last time, but let's make some different ones. Let's say, what if we wanted to, say, assign a structural description to the source language and then use that to translate things? So as we said, you know, we could, the pieces that were moving around in this sentence when we translated from German to English weren't arbitrary. You know, the subject was in the second part of the sentence, and in English, subjects tend to be in the first part of the sentence. So if we know what subjects and objects are, maybe we can do better. So this is a tree-to-string translation, where you use a syntactic analysis of the source sentence, and then you transfer from the tree to the target language string. So we have different sets of independence assumptions that we're making here. And you know, these are kind of nice models. Source syntax is kind of a proxy for semantic relationships in the language. It kind of says who did what to whom, and you can use this as a source of constraints on reordering to make that NP hard problem maybe a little more tractable. Okay, obviously, maybe we don't have a source language parser. Maybe we instead want to know. We think syntax plays a bigger role on the target side. You know, if you want to get a good model of how English is working, you need to understand something about syntactic dependencies. So we can assume the same thing. And here we're just going to do string to tree translation. And this is a nice problem. It seems like, wow, how would you do that? Isn't that like a crazy hard problem? It turns out that algorithmically, this is just a generalization of monolingual parsing. So you can actually use standard algorithms with minimal modifications, things like CKY, to do parsing. And the intuition, these are actually very, very effective models. So the best Chinese English systems are string to tree. I think that is also true for a few other languages. And the intuition here is that, you know, when you're doing translation, in general, it's more important that you know what's going on in the target language than that you know what's going on in the source language. I can kind of guess what some check signs mean, but so I could write a plausible translation, but I would never be able to produce even a single check word if I was asked to go the other direction. Okay, and of course, we can imagine going between the two. So we can do tree-to-tree translation. This has also got its benefits. We might also say, you know what, maybe I want to go somewhere even more abstract than syntax. I want to go to a semantic level of representation. Maybe I want to go to the target language semantics and then read syntax off of that and then read the target language translation off of that. We can also then say, well, maybe the target language syntax should come from the source language syntax. So we can basically build up, you know, thinking about translation using a whole bunch of different layers of representation on the source and the target. And ultimately, we might decide that what we really want is a model where we have a representation that's universal, that's language independent of what is actually being encoded in a sentence. And we can, you know, each of these components, each of these arrows could be conditional independence assumptions, for example. These could be statistical models, so it could still be statistical. But we could do things this way. And actually, this structure that we've ended up building here is called the Vauquois triangle. And this is a traditional way of thinking about the different ways you can approach the translation problem. So this seems, you know, I like to think about interlingual representations, but it's really hard. So modeling challenges with these abstract models are basically, there are a whole bunch of challenges. We have modeling challenges, we have computational challenges, and we have learning challenges. And I want to really emphasize this last one, because this is really why these models, I think, aren't being used here. So when we've got something like this, and we look at our parallel data, all of this is hidden. Nobody bothers when they translate the United Nations to do anything but say, here's how you say it in German, here's how you say it in English. They didn't go through and annotate a bunch of latent structure. So we have to get that from somewhere else if we want to use it. We have to either learn it as a latent variable, we have to build transducers, so we have to build a tree bank that says, here's how you go from English syntax to, or from English sentences to English parses and vice versa. And people disagree, you know, as you get higher and higher up in this, you know, syntax, people argue enough about syntax, but you can get a tree bank. If you ask people about semantics, you know, there are religious wars fought over less. And if you were actually to get to meaning, then I think all bets are off. You know, people are just, so basically it's a big project. You have to believe quite strongly in whatever you're doing here if you're going to try and annotate this data. So all of this is hidden in sort of standard parallel data. And so it's sort of a warning for those who believe strongly that this is the way we should be doing things. So I'm going to end just with some other challenges to think about, which is that, you know, we do have a lot of parallel data, but it tends to be in domains like this where people are wishing each other a happy new year in the hope that you enjoyed a pleasant festive period, which is, you know, a very nice statement. But if you look then at what people actually use in other domains, and which you might want to translate, you get things like this, which maybe we're a little too optimistic about the value of our parallel data, and it's like you ask, well, why are you looking for the keys over there when you lost them over there? And it's like, well, that's where the light is. And so I think you know this is the upper one is where the light is, and the lower one is maybe what we should be spending some time thinking about. So maybe that would be enough to motivate some of these other forms of modeling. Okay, we have lots of different things going on there. Okay, so that's all. So questions? I bet you can. So there was this interesting paper a few years ago that showed you could crawl parallel data from you could get examples from linguistic papers out of the interlingual glosses there. And my guess is you could linguists like to work on Chukchi. It's one of these like cool phonology languages, and evidently also morphology. So I bet you could find, you know, maybe a dozen sentences that way. But unfortunately, no. If you're interested in really crazy morphology languages, there is a language spoken in northern Canada called Inuktitut, which is a real polysynthetic language, and it is the parliamentary proceedings are published in that. And although there are only about 30,000 native speakers of this language, there's a parallel corpus, actually multi-parallel, English, French, and Inuktitut, with over 500,000 sentences. So that means for every man, woman, and child, there are, you know, about 20 Inuktitut sentences. So I don't know if they just have this, you know, if this is what they all do all day is translate. But the data's out there for some of these unusual languages. All right. Yep. Thank you. Well, so one thing I want to state extremely strongly is that we need to be careful to distinguish statistical methods and naive models. So very often, so naive models are things that just say the only things that are true are the things that I see on the surface. So these are white space delimited tokens, which, as you point out, is a reasonable assumption for English and a progressively less realistic assumption as you go into more morphologically rich languages or do other things, like maybe look at things like Twitter. But what we are it's not to say that statistics doesn't have a role to play when we start having more latent structure. In fact, I think statistics, the value of statistics and really thinking about what modeling assumptions we're making becomes more and more important as we start dealing with more abstract or less observed phenomena in the sense. So if we're going to be modeling things like gender or animacy or something like that, we need to be really careful because we could end up, if you have a model that's capable of modeling things that it hasn't seen, we want to model things that haven't been seen but are actually correct in some sense. And so the value, the sort of job of the statistical model becomes more and more important. But that being said, yeah, and the other thing I think is you're right, English has completely distorted our view of how to solve language processing problems. It's a typological outlier. It's a boring language in a lot of ways. And if we go back and thought about the language modeling problem, I think if Czech was the language everybody was speaking who developed language models, I think our sort of default language models will look very, very different than what today's do. So, yeah, I think you're right. Yeah. Yeah. That's the idea, yeah.
Can you benefit from getting a library of different languages?
I think, really if we're gonna do something like this other than so first, yes, anybody who annotates, who develops an interlingua, the more languages we work on, the better it's going to be. The other thing is we have translations, not just in pairs of languages, but in many languages, or in many corpora, we have, 20, 30 way, look at the European Union, all the languages are all the documents are published in 26 languages. We can then, we know a lot more than about how language works in general, or we could potentially learn a lot more than just looking at things pairwise. So I think those resources are very important if we're gonna try and learn something like this.